This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This half hour is brought to you by Larson & Larson. They're my intellectual property lawyers, and they should be yours. Well, this is really exciting. I always love to talk to authors on the day that their book is released. And so today I'm talking to Catherine McGee, whose book is called The Thousandth Floor, and it's Welcome to Manhattan in 2118. Hi. Well, welcome to Joy on Paper, Catherine.
Thank you so much, Patsy. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, well, it's wonderful for me, and especially because I know that you're from Houston, right?
Yes, I am.
And both of my boys were born in Houston. We lived there quite a few years. And so I always love to talk to somebody from Houston.
Oh, it was a great place to grow up. I really love it there.
Yeah, well, we had a great time. We lived up just 17th hole of Champions Golf Course. So it's a nice area up there.
It's so fun, although it is really too hot right now.
Oh, yeah.
Hot and humid.
Definitely, definitely. Well, I was trying to think of a word. I always like to think of a word to describe an author. But in your case, it's like, I mean, I couldn't even think of anything. Spectacular, impressive, awesome, stupendous.
You can't see me, but I'm blushing.
Well, I think breathtaking. I mean, absolutely breathtaking. Much like the view from the thousandth floor would be, because your career has taken off like, woo! It's amazing.
It has been such a whirlwind. I've been so lucky and really have enjoyed every moment of it.
Well, you're going to have so much fun. It's just amazing. And I'm so thrilled for you, because this doesn't happen all that often, that an author's first book, it's hard to believe it's your first book. I was reading it and I kept saying, this is her first book. It's a complex book. You have different points of view. You have so many characters. Wow, I couldn't believe it was your first book.
I know. It was a beast of an outline. I will tell you that color-coded outline went through a lot of revisions, and it still changed quite a bit during the drafting process, but I could not have done it without outlining first. No question.
Well, you mentioned that color-coding outline. That's very nice because, you know, this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing and for everyone who wants to write, you know. So you found the color coding was a great way, isn't it, to keep track of everything?
I did. You know, I adhere quite strictly to a three-act story structure, which, you know, is really a screenwriting technique. And I would say,
I know that.
Don't look too closely at my book, but it really does pretty closely follow a three-act structure with all of the highs and lows coming kind of at the midpoint and then, you know, at that final crescendo at the end of Act 2 when everything sort of comes together, it comes to a head. And so that was helpful to me to write. You know, it changed, as I said, somewhat over the course of writing, but in my outline at least, I tried to make sure that I kept track of where everyone's story turns were so that all of the story turns intersected at the proper places. And I have found that helpful, and I often recommend to writers to read, you know, just any screenwriting 101 book, because I think that that's training that from Hollywood that is actually more applicable to novels than many people have realized.
Well, I agree. I'm a screenwriter, so I understand where you're coming.
Oh, so you know what I mean.
Exactly. And it is true that it really helps. And of course, in your case, I mean, like you sold the rights to the TV series before you even finished the book, I understand.
I did. I sold the rights based on the partial manuscript, which was the first 7 chapters. So I was really lucky. I have a fantastic agent, and he made that happen for me. And I'm just so glad that ABC saw something in the manuscript that they found intriguing.
Well, you have an agent who is literally worth his weight in gold because he has done something so fantastic for you. It's just, I mean, it is breathtaking. Just like this.
I'm so excited.
Well, it is. Let's talk a little bit, tell people a little bit about the Thousands Floor because it's where you got the idea. You know, my hands were sort of sweaty. My sister gets really afraid of any floor above like the third floor. So when I read, I thought, and she loves to, you know, read all the books that I get. And I thought, I don't even know if I can give it to her. She'll start shaking because a thousand floor is up. But it is.
I know. And it opens with someone falling. So I'm afraid I might give your sister vertigo.
That's what I thought.
I know. Yeah. So the thousandth floor takes place 100 years in the future in Manhattan when most of the city has become one enormous skyscraper that is 1,000 stories tall. And the book opens with an unnamed girl dying, falling from the top of the tower to her death. And you don't know who she is or why she is falling, whether she slipped and fell accidentally or whether she was pushed or whether she decided to jump off. And then the book backtracks 2 months and you meet 5 characters in rapid succession, all of whom are teenagers living in this futuristic 1,000-story skyscraper. And you follow all of their stories as they intersect. And the stories are really tales of romance and friendship and relationships and family stories. So one of the characters, you know, learns something about herself that basically causes her to question everything she thought she knew and who she is and what she wants. And then another character is incredibly insecure and struggles with addiction. Another character is fighting very hard to keep her family together and facing financial troubles. And then there's kind of a snarky hacker who is spying on many of the other characters and possesses more secrets than he should. And finally, there is the girl who lives on the 1,000th floor in the ultimate penthouse, literally lives on top of the world. And yet she seems to have everything, but she wants the one thing that she can never have.
And that's Avery Fuller, and really a great character that you've developed.
Oh, thank you. I know. She's a little bit unusual in that she is perfect, but she was genetically made to be so. So she's the ultimate custom order baby. Her parents basically paid a genetic specialist to comb through all of their DNA and put her together, you know, one DNA strand at a time so that she would be tall and blonde and physically flawless and incredibly smart. But, you know, that can't stop you from seeking a forbidden love.
Aha. So that's all part of the really intriguing story that you weave in it. I don't know. They're saying that it's like a teenager, young adult. Is that what it's aimed for, the market?
Yes. So it is a young adult novel. That said, young adult has had such a resurgence in the past few years with The Hunger Games and Harry Potter. And so I think there have been more and more readers of young adult who are no longer teenagers or no longer even in their 20s. And I think that's because these stories, the transitions that people go through at the ages of, you know, 17, 18, are really the biggest changes of your life, certainly to date. And they feel monumental because you go to college, you move away from home. You realize that your parents are flawed and don't know everything.
Oh, no, I don't. I don't want. We're not flawed. We're not flawed.
No, we're not flawed. Exactly. You're right. Well, and that's kind of the age that many people experience their first big love and have their hearts broken. And so I think that there's something about that particular time of life that has always resonated with readers of all ages. I mean, if you look back even at, you know, Dickensian novels of you know, 18th century Britain, a lot of them have characters who are teenagers, and they weren't called young adult at the time, but still, they're coming of age novels. So I think there will be a lot of teenage fans of this, but I hope there will be older fans as well.
I think there will be. I think it's going to catch on. And of course, once the television series comes out, it's going to be amazing. So this is one of, Do you know how many books you're planning to do? It's a trilogy.
It is a trilogy. So there will be 3 books.
Oh, wow. It's always fantastic to be able to plan that. Well, when you've done 7 chapters and you've already sold the... Yes, definitely you have a trilogy there. Where did you get the idea for the... I mean, it's very clever. As a matter of fact, I was thinking about you this morning at 4:30 in the morning because my kitchen sink backed up and it is like a mess. And I was thinking, oh, gosh,
oh, no.
I wish I had a cleaning bot.
I was going to say that wouldn't happen in the future. Everything is seamless and automatic.
It's wonderful. I think that's my favorite part. I mean,
I did a lot of thinking about the future. I knew that I wanted to set a story in a futuristic world and an optimistic future, not a dark dystopia. And the original kind of starting point for the setting actually came from an article I read about a project in China called Sky City, which is this idea of a self-contained skyscraper that is one enormous city. And this one will be 480 stories tall, will contain hospitals and schools and apartments for millions of people, and even these spiraling vertical farms that are illuminated from solar panels. And so once I had that idea for a vertical city, I was just really intrigued by it. And then because I was living in New York at the time and really do love New York, I couldn't help but set it in Manhattan.
Well, it's very clever. And explain why some people live on top and some people live below.
Well, as with any modern building, I think the higher that you go, you know, the floors have higher ceilings and the views are better, and so the real estate just becomes more expensive. Similarly to New York of the present, you know, New York is already a city of neighborhoods. I think when you live in New York, one of the first questions that people ask you if they meet you for the first time is, where do you live? And people make assumptions about you and your personality based on the answer you give, whether you say the Upper East Side or Williamsburg or the West Village or Tribeca. You know, these are all neighborhoods and they all have their own personalities. And so what I've done in the novel with this, you know, vertical tower is really I've just kind of taken the neighborhoody aspect of New York and just shot it skyward. So now your neighborhoods are not only, you know, stretching horizontally, but also vertically. And in my mind, they really do. You know, there might be a neighborhood that's 10 floors tall, but encompasses only a few city blocks, or it might be one floor that's all one thing, you know, sandwiched between 2 different neighborhoods. So it's definitely just a bigger, crazier version of the way that New York already is. But certainly the penthouse apartment on the 1,000th floor is the most expensive real estate in the entire world.
The ultimate.
The ultimate, exactly.
Well, I love really some of your ideas are things that I hadn't even thought about for the future. And how much research did you do into the future?
I tried to do a decent amount of research. So I've found myself much more in the last couple of years following science blogs and reading articles, you know, about scientific discoveries and about startups who are working in the tech space. I was lucky enough, because I was living in California while I was writing the book in the San Francisco Bay Area, that I could both, you know, pick the brains of some of my classmates who were working on kind of futuristic startups and also get to try some things out. So I did get to try some virtual reality headsets and things like that, which definitely helped me envision this future world. That said, there are certain things in the book that are just science fiction elements that I made up for the fun of it. The biggest being anti-gravity yoga is currently against all the laws of physics as we understand them. But that doesn't mean that we might not find a loophole in gravity in the next 100 years.
Yep.
You know, who am I to say?
Exactly. And you can make it's your world. It's so fantastic. You've made this entire world in this 1,000 floor building. It's fantastic.
It was so much fun, and I hope that people enjoy it, and I hope that it makes some readers more optimistic about the future than they currently feel.
Well, I do like that, because I am really over all the dark future. I don't think people, you know, things are dark enough. We don't need any more dark future. We need this sort of optimism. And yet the people, I mean, in point of fact, the actual characters are all going through the same kind of thing that people are going through today. So people haven't developed so much as the things around them. And you would.
Exactly. You know, unfortunately, I think human nature
is human
has not
nature.
Changed very much since probably the dawn of time.
That's right. You can read Stendhal or you can read, you know, Tolstoy, whoever you, nothing much has changed in the human character. We have
exactly.
good people and bad people and envious people and proud people and people who are just, you know, good. And so I like that you have all of this sort of intertwined here, all of these different storylines.
Exactly. It was very important to me to show that, you know, even in the future when things seem more connected and, you know, everything is faster and safer, people can still fall in and out of love with one another and betray one another. And, you know, love can both save you and harm you.
Well, you have done. You've done, I think, a really great story. It's a, you know, I had at first thought it was going to be a sci-fi, but it's not. It's a really a human story, a love story, sort of entwined with all the other dramatic stories involved. I think it's really nice. I really like it.
Thank you. I was calling it sci-fi light for certain readers because I don't want to scare people away and have them think that there are aliens or zombies or evil robots. There's no Terminator in my book, but it has a tiny bit of sci-fi in it.
Yeah, like this. Yoga. I like it.
Like the yoga. You get a really good stretch out of yoga when there's no gravity holding you down.
Sounds
that's for
good.
Sure.
And you might weigh less. but you did a great job with it. And I don't know. I have to ask this because all of my listeners are going to ask me when I have a next workshop. They're going to say, did you find an agent by a query letter? Or did you meet somebody I'm telling this story. Like, I'd like to just walk up to an agent somewhere and say, "Okay, I'm going to tell you this story."
I know. I was very lucky because I already worked in publishing.
Ah.
So I was actually working in editorial, so my path to publishing is very non-traditional because I sort of had an inside track. So, I was working in the business, and I basically got this idea, wrote the prologue and the first chapter pretty much as they are still written. They have changed. They're the only things that really never changed over the course of my editing. And took them, just walked down the hall to my boss, who is now my agent, basically, and put them on his desk and said, "Will you read this when you get a moment?" And then later in the day, he called me in and he said, I don't know what this is, but you need to keep writing it. So what? Then I wrote 7 chapters. He and I edited them together for about at least 8 months, and then he went on sale with it for me.
Well, you're breathtaking, and he's a genius too. So
I'm very lucky. I know that a lot of people spend a long time trying to get agents' attention, and certainly when they know you by your first name. And when, I mean, I had been working for him for many years, and so I he couldn't really ignore me.
Well, it's one way actually to get experience to enter into the publishing world. You certainly learn a lot. Now, what program do you write in?
I still write in Microsoft Word, but I save to Google Drive. So I've learned that the hard way.
Yes, did
actually,
you lose things?
I'm looking at my computer right now, and I have a sticker on it that my fiance put on it for me that says "Save early, saved often," because I had a mini crisis last summer where I lost, it wasn't that many chapters, but I lost, I think, 4 chapters because I was not saving automatically to Google Drive. I was saving locally to my hard drive, and then my hard drive crashed. And I'm not going to lie, I went to the Apple store and I started crying. And I told my editor this story, and she said, "You aren't a real writer until you've cried in the Apple store." So
you've made it.
I guess it's a rite of passage.
Yes, I think so. It's happened to all of us. Luckily, I have a computer genius in my family, so they help me out in these terrible moments of life.
I know. If only we still all wrote on pen and paper, but it's just too time consuming.
Yeah. Well, I just want to thank you so much. It's just fantastic, Catherine. And I want to tell everyone, your book came out today officially, and it's called The Thousandth Floor by Catherine McGee. And Catherine is spelled with a K, so if they were, type it in. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all sorts of wonderful places like that and in bookstores. And the cover is beautiful. I love that cover.
The cover turned out amazing. I have some really talented designers.
Wow.
I'm very pleased with the cover.
Yeah, it's very dramatic. And the little video that they have on Amazon with it is really nice. It's well worth watching. So I just want to wish you the best of luck. I'm always happy to hear, as I said, from somebody from Houston. And you've done a marvelous job, Catherine.
Well, thank you so much for reading, and thank you for hosting me.
Okay, well, I'm going to put it up on my archive page because I know everybody is going to be interested in finding out how you managed to do this. And we're looking forward to when the second book comes out, you have to come back on. And, of course, when the TV series is up and running.
Yes, let's all keep our fingers crossed for it.
Oh, I think it's going to be great because you've done what a writer has to do. You've told a good story, and that's the basis of everything that we do is telling a good story, and you have done it.
Thank you so much, Katia. That means a lot to me.
Okay, well, take care and have lots of fun on your book tour and all your interviews and just keep writing. It's just been a joy for me to talk to you. Goodbye now. Okay. Well, she's so busy today. Whenever they have the official book launch, it's amazing. We're going to take a little break. And then when I come back, I have Martha Alderson on. And she is going to talk to us about plots and lots of interesting stuff and also her new book. We'll be right back.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Charles Ruttenberg Realty proudly sponsors Joy on Paper with Patsy Gill. Charles Ruttenberg sets the standard of excellence with residential and commercial real estate transactions and can help you on your next transaction, whether that is for a second home, investment, or downsizing. Call us today at 727-538-9200 extension 2 and allow me to help you. I'm John Rakowski, the broker at Charles Ruttenberg Realty.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Larson & Larson is a proud sponsor of Joy on Paper. Our law firm has the experience and knowledge to help you protect your valuable intellectual property. From trademark, copyright, and patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements, the attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, are here to advise you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com. That's Larson & Larson, your intellectual property attorneys.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, and I'm so happy to welcome back to the program. She was here a few months ago, she's back by popular demand, Martha Alderson. Hi, Martha.
Hello. Thank you, Patsy, for inviting me back. This is exciting.
Okay. Well, you know, it's so nice. As I mentioned to you in an email, I always love when, you know, the listeners come back to me and tell me, you know, what interviews they enjoy. And so I was really thrilled when I had someone on the program the other week, and he said that he went to my archive page and he listened to your interview twice because he learned so much from it.
That's great.
And of course, you're famous for plots, and your newest book is Writing Blockbuster Plots. So
yes.
So
it's sort of a new old book. I self-published it 12 years ago, and then Writer's Digest just re-released it. So, you know, it's updated and expanded, and they have a page on their website with all kinds of, you know, I'm kind of known for these plot planners and scene trackers that are visual templates that kind of help writers see their story, you know, to get away from the words, to actually see the inner structure. And, yeah, so I'm really excited that it gets to come back and is resurrected.
Well, you know, before we talk about, I want to get to you all details about plots and all of that. Let's talk first about you have your own new book, a novel that just came out, right?
Oh, I'm so excited. Yes, Parallel Lives.
So tell us about that.
Okay, it's set in San Francisco, and the main emphasis is in the 1960s in San Francisco, which is, you know, when the whole Flower Children sort of happened here in California. And what I wanted to do was to show what happens to some native Californians, you know, people that have been brought up and raised here with this huge influx of people that are coming from all over the country and all over the world with their sort of fantasies of the place and how they come with their fantasies and then sort of change the area to reflect their dreams of the place. So it's about two people who their lives keep intersecting or converging, and they don't know why. And they're sort of left to try to find each other and explore and find out who they are to each other and why do their paths keep crossing. And each of the major crossings are a major historical event in California at the time, like when the Native Americans took over Alcatraz and when Robert Kennedy came to break fast with Cesar Chavez and a farm worker's benefit at the Fillmore with Carlos Santana, and just sort of neat historical events that people may have forgotten, may never have known about, and that they can see it through the eyes of these two protagonists that are very sort of fearsome, and as they make their way through this kind of class cataclysmic change that's happening here in California.
And so it's ideal for baby boomers who will remember those events.
Yes, I think so. And maybe even millennials who are curious about.
And they are. They are. Yeah. They all want to know what was it like back then when you tell them the stories about, they say, oh, did that really happen?
Well, and a lot of things that are told about San Francisco in those days and lots of images that you see are in the Haight-Ashbury. You know, there's a lot of really heavy drugs and, you know, you can sort of see the grittier side. And I don't shy away from that in the book, but that's definitely not the focus because that was really more developed, these outsiders that came into San Francisco to sort of, you know, find their dreams of the place. But that wasn't really what was happening to the mainstream population here in Northern California when, you know, everything just went so crazy.
Well, I think, you know, I haven't had a chance to read the book. Yeah. Are you there? What happened?
Hello?
I hear you. Okay. I don't know. I thought something happened to you. I haven't had a chance.
Hello?
Okay. We're on. Are you there, Martha? Okay. Well, I don't know. Somehow we dropped Martha, and we'll try to get her back in a little while. She's in California, and I hope she had enough coffee so she didn't fall asleep. So anyway, we're going to try to get her back on.
Hello? But
I hear you, Martha. Do you hear me? I don't know. She doesn't hear me. Oh, we always love to have fun. That's what happens with live radio. Maybe we'll hang up on her and try to call her back. Well, Big Ed is back. He's been on vacation. He just came back from the Virgin Islands. And so it's nice to have him back in the control room. And he's going to try to get Martha back on. And meanwhile, I want to say again, okay, we got Martha. Okay. Are we back, Martha?
Oh, I wonder what happened. I'm so sorry.
I don't know.
You say hello, hello.
Yeah, we heard you say hello, hello. We were saying it too. These things happen. That's what happens on live radio. It's fun.
Too bad. I'm sorry.
No, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So anyway, as I was saying, I didn't get a chance to read Parallel Lives. I know it's just come out, and I'm so happy that you got your novel out. And, of course, I'm sure you followed your advice about writing blockbuster plots. And it sounds exciting.
And actually, most of the techniques that I came up with and the teaching that I've done and lots of the things that I've written about, you know, have really come through me, because as I was learning and developing and writing myself, as I would find things that would be helpful to other writers, or writers would hear about what I was doing and would ask me to share it with them. So it really all, yes, was to help my own writing, but then it sort of evolved out into helping other writers with their writing. So it's been an interesting career.
Well, you know, you talk in your book, you talk about plots and how to develop them, and you use some examples of some books that are well plotted.
Yes.
So give us an example of a well plotted book and why it's well plotted. What went right with that book?
Well, I've tried to analyze all kinds of books, because I want to show the universality of sort of plot and structure. And I like to say that I invite writers to experience the freedom of structure, because even though that sounds like an oxymoron, it's really to show that within this structure, you can do anything. And that's where your creativity and your imagination and all of that sort of comes forward. But this universal structure for plot and scenes is what's expected by readers who are, you know, who have been read to as children and now are pretty voracious readers or just really enjoy the act of reading. They come to expect a certain rhythm, and I call this whole thing the universal story. And so I found them in classics and romance and contemporary and screenplays, memoirs, and it really does resonate. I have tried to just stick to, you know, classics and award-winning, because I want to show how writers do it who have been successful. So, you know, I've plotted out stories that goes from, you know, Gone with the Wind to The Kite Runner to The Hunger Games to Harry Potter. I've done, you know, some screenplays that are I can't even think of any off the top of my head right now. But anyway, so I really have done a little bit of everything in order to show all different sorts of writers that this is applicable to you, too. And if you understand it, and it is sort of counterintuitive to a lot of writers who are more creative and like the, you know, the discovery and the exploration of writing, and really kind of balk and turn away from such a structured approach. But if you can embrace it or just sort of lean into it even, it really allows you to settle into your writing in a different way, because you're not writing in a void and sort of going down these dark alleys and finding yourself, you know, at a dead end. But you can pre-plot and have your mind and imagination working toward the end, the climax, the, you know, the crisis, the things that are going to come later in the story as you're writing early on, so that you don't end up with a story that's, you know, 600 pages long and it's just rambling all over the place and you look at all of that and say to yourself, now what do I do? So this is just a way to be able to understand what's at the core of every great story and to be able to use it in your own stories.
Well, earlier this hour, I interviewed Catherine McGee, whose new book, mm-hmm. The Thousandth Floor, and she mentioned that she follows basically the three-act idea of plotting, of having much like a screenplay.
Right. And I do the same thing, only rather than just the beginning, middle, and end, which is usually considered the three acts, I throw in a fourth act so that the middle is divided in two. In other words, within the three act paradigm, the beginning is a quarter of the page count or word count or scene count. The middle is one half of the entire story. And the end is one quarter. So by dividing the middle in half, that allows for four sort of equal parts in your story, a beginning, I call it the emerging middle, the deep middle, and then the end. And each one of those has their very own set of expectations
And they follow an arc. They have their own arc.
And the expectations in each section are different than the expectations in the other sections. And so if you're aware that as you start to get to the three-quarter mark, the energy of the story is starting to rise. Things are, the protagonist may feel like she's getting really close to what she wants, to her long-term goal. Things are going okay. She still has to, she's coming up against obstacles. And then, boom, she hits a wall. And whatever she thought, she was, solving the mystery only to find that the murderer is now dead and, was murdered by the real murderer. Or she finds that the man that she fell in love with wasn't who she thought it was. Or, she's stripped of everything so that there's an actual crisis that happens, either at the dramatic action level, which means, what she's going toward, there's some sort of twist or something bad that happens, or an internal sort of existential kind of crisis where she sees herself in a new light, in a new way, and then has to sort of adjust to that and make changes in the last quarter of the story. So if you can sort of know what's coming and start to expect that or have that expectation, your imagination will start to flow in that direction. And so, so the middle is so daunting. Every writer that I've ever talked to almost, they flounder in the middle, especially the middle of the middle. They start to really wonder, where am I going? What's happening with the story? This is harder than I thought. I've got too many plot lines. I don't know who's doing what anymore. I'm going to go back and start over at the beginning, and I'm going to really get organized and But the problem is that the middle of the story is meant to do that. It's a testing ground almost for writers. Can you get through this? Can you work your way through this? Because you then will reach the prize, which is the climax at the end, which means that you've finished your story. And going back to the beginning and starting over is really almost shooting yourself in the foot, because you'll end up doing that over and over again and really never get very far. You'll just keep going back to the beginning and play in a territory that you feel familiar with and feel like you're in control of, whereas what I really urge writers to do is to push yourself into the nitty-gritty, which is the middle, the three-quarter part of your story, where the worst happens to these characters that you love the most. And you've got to sit there and write those, moment by moment in dramatic scenes in order for the reader to, to really feel like the story is moving and the character is changing.
Well, I was trying to think of books that particularly point this out. Mary Higgins Clark's books have this just natural flow. She's just mastered this technique of the first part and the middle part, where she does have always the two elements to it, and then the final. So there is a definite style, but it works. I mean, it works every time. You're reading her books and you think, well, maybe it's not going to get, and then it gets up, and then it goes up, and then it goes up, and you know, and it's fantastic, the arc that she manages always to put into her books, which is why they're always bestsellers. I mean, because it has a natural, what we think of now as a natural flow to the story. And I think in many cases it's exactly the way, if one is telling a story, one would tell it anyway.
And in my background, I used to work with kids who had speech, language, and learning disabilities. So I've worked a lot with readers, you know, who are struggling readers, and a lot of adults as well. But, you know, about three-quarters of the way or halfway through a story, things can start to drag for the reader. And what you want is to engage them. You want the middle to become more of a page-turner even than the beginning was, so that they will stay with you and read to the end of your story. So if you don't have these high points, if you don't have these obstacles and dilemmas and, you know, setbacks and things that twist all over the place, the reader is more apt to put the book down and, you know, say, I'm going to pick it up later, but they may never pick it up again, because you have to get that sense of hooking the reader and then keeping them hooked throughout the entire story. And it's daunting. I mean, you can't really, you know, let the energy of the story wane for too long. And so that's a challenge. How do you constantly keep the dramatic action high and the excitement, you know, in such a way that the reader is turning pages to try to figure out what's going to happen next? Is she going to get what she wants? Is she going to survive? Is the bad guy going to get her? And then you really engaged your reader. And I like to say, beginnings hook readers, but endings create fans. Because
that's
what they'll
true.
Be left with is the end of the story, and that's what they're going to talk to their friends about. So all that work you do, you know, the 150 times you write the beginning chapter or the beginning of your story, readers won't remember as much as they're going to remember that last quarter, which is where I really ask writers to put a lot of their time and attention.
Well, it's true that it is that ending that when a reader finishes a book and they say, oh, it's done, I want more.
Exactly.
That's what you're aiming for. That's, you know, all of the most successful writers. It's like, it's whether it's a David Hagberg or a Brad Thor, Vince Flynn, Mary Higgins Clark. When you finish the book, you want more.
You don't want it to end. And there's that paradox of wanting to read really, really quickly because you want to see what happens, but then you also want to really slow down because you don't want it to end. So that's when you really know that you've got the reader hooked and excited about your story, and then they're going to be looking for your next book instead of just sort of forgetting all about you. So it's not easy, and for most writers who are highly creative, you know, and really love words and making beautiful sentences and coming up with quirky characters and developing their inner, you know, psyche, this is all really, you know, I have friends who are like that, and as soon as I start talking about any of this, you know, their hands start to sweat, they want to change the subject, because it really is, you know, you're asking a creative person to buy into sort of a logical, linear, organized structure, which is really not comfortable because that's not where they spend most of their time. So I find that I work a lot with those kinds of writers because they know they need a plot, they know they need structure, but it's not a comfortable place to be. And so they need to sort of have some support through that. Whereas the more logical writers who are really good at plot, they usually sort of break down when it comes to the character development and really creating a character that's three-dimensional, not just sort of a cardboard character that pushes the plot along.
Now, I know the old version of your book had worksheets and suggestions on exercises to do. Does the writing blockbuster plots, the new book, have a worksheets? Yep. Yeah?
All of those, and they have Writer's Digest has actually made a page on their website with a lot of my plot planners that I've plotted out to show some of these examples of books that I've looked at so that you can actually see what it looks like, you know, and I also have some of these on some boards on Pinterest to show how other writers set up their plot planners or their scene trackers. And it's really just a place, like a plot planner is a line that follows the energy of this universal story. I recommend that, you know, writers can put it up on a wall or somewhere where they can see it and interact with it. And it's just a place to sort of put your notes and put your ideas so that you're plotting out as you're going or you're pre-plotting so that you never really come up against a blank page because you have these ideas that you have put on this line to figure out, okay, what's coming next and I'm working toward this big moment. And so it's just a visual for, I don't know, being back in the day of working with kids that have learning problems, visual aids are very helpful. You know, it grounds people. They can read it or they can hear it. But if you can really see it, and you know the writer's mantra, show, don't tell. So I try to tell in the, you know, in the book and writing Blockbuster Plus, but I also try to show by having all these templates so that writers can look at those and understand what the heck I'm talking about.
Well, I recommend to writers that they go to your website, which is?
MarthaAlderson.com.
MarthaAlderson.com. And it's you have links there to everything, and including some of your workshops and your video series. And as Catherine McGee was telling me earlier, she color codes her plots and her characters, and so that she can visualize everything. And it's a good idea, exactly what you said. You have to, if you have these aids to your thinking process, it's right. Very useful.
I think they are. And so in writing Blockbuster Plots, it's more the linear approach. It's got the templates. It's got the explanation of these big major turning points. It talks a lot about the character development. It goes into, theme and how to bring meaning to your overall story. And so that's more for people who are just looking for the nuts and bolts of plot. But then the Plot Whisperer, which is really what gained me the bestseller status, is more for these sort of right-brained, more creative type of writers who struggle with the process. And in the Plot Whisperer book, I really try to show what the protagonist is going through and then compare it to what the writer is going through at the same time, because it sort of is this universal journey, and writers are going to come up against the same sorts of obstacles and dilemmas and setbacks as their protagonist will, and if they can be aware of that, you know, the writers, they then can understand how to inject that into their character. If they can see the struggle that they go through personally, they then have better ideas of how to show that emotionality in their protagonist when the protagonist comes up against all these roadblocks.
Well, Martha, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I know that, as I said, my listeners listen to you, and so it's so nice that you joined me, and I want to have you back. I know you did a book about how to write children's books, and I have quite a few listeners who are working on children's books and need advice, so perhaps you'll come back another time and talk to us specifically about children's books.
I love that. I actually have a video series on how to write a picture book. If you're talking about picture books,
uh-huh.
Or
picture books,
if you're
yeah.
talking about middle grade or
no
YA,
picture books,
I have
yeah.
something else. Yeah. And then just to quickly tell your listeners, if you want me to come and visit your book group, if you decide to read Parallel Lives, my novel, I would love to come to your book group via Skype, and we can talk about process. You can tell me your comments about the book. You know, we can talk about plot. I can tell you the sorts of things that I did. But I thought it might be a fun way to be able to integrate teaching and learning into, you know, a book group or a critique group.
Well, I will do that. As a matter of fact, I'm starting one in the fall, and I'm going to book you for that, and we'll have you on Skype, and you can talk to my listeners who are going to be joining me, okay?
Oh, I would love that. That would be so fun.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Kathy.
Okay. Thank you, Martha. Thanks for joining me.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Wow. That's nice. You know, the Miami Avenue Book Nook opened up last week, and we're going to be holding some meetups in the evening, on Wednesday evenings and on Saturday afternoons. And so one of the evenings, we will have Martha by Skype, and we will be able to talk to her, and you'll be able to ask her questions. And if you haven't yet been to the Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach, please go. It's just wonderful. Bev Malley, the owner of Miami Avenue, is a fantastic hostess. In the evenings, they have music on Tuesday nights. Tonight is karaoke, and Thursday is jazz. And then on the weekends, they have dancing music. So it's a wonderful location, a beautiful venue, and with the Book Nook, we're showcasing all sorts of local authors, and one of them I want to mention particularly, Gino Bardi. I love his book, A Cow in the Doorway, and for any of you baby boomers, you should get this book. It's really, really funny, and Gino did a fantastic job with this book. I love the cover. It's very funny, and the story is about a coming of age, this time a guy who goes to Cornell University and the first year at school, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful book. And so that's Gino Bardi's book, and it's available at the Book Nook. And then I want to remind you, it's going to be the first on Thursday, and that means Irene Goodman is opening up her critique auction. So go to her website. It's IreneGoodman.com, and all the money goes to charity, and you will get the best critique in the world, because Irene Goodman is just one of the top literary agents in New York City, and her work will be so useful to you. So think about joining in the auction by going to her website. And meanwhile, tonight, as I said, is karaoke night, and you never know, I might show up there tonight just for fun. And just enjoy yourself, and on Thursday, I've got some more guests coming up, and it's going to be really exciting. And, you know, when you think about Catherine McGee, wow, it's amazing to be able to sell a miniseries before your book is even published. Anyway, it was wonderful to hear from Martha this time, and we'll see her on Skype in the fall. Okay, bye-bye for now. See you on Thursday back here at 11 o'clock on Tan Talk Radio Network.